Okay, let's get started then. This is the second lecture in the series, today I'm going to go through 400 years of history. Okay, that's pretty fast. Remember the rules. You'll have to take notes or pretend to take notes. Reassure me. Okay, so we left last week when the Romans left Britain. How did they leave Britain? Well, why did they leave Britain? Well, first of all, they left Britain because of attacks on Rome elsewhere in Europe. They needed the army to... Would you like to be a gladiator? No, thank you. Okay, they needed the army, when they left Britain, they had not conquered the whole of Britain. The north of Scotland had remained gloriously independent, although really independent is probably too modern a word for a tribal situation with very local chieftains having frequent small-scale local wars, blood feuds, and so on and so forth. The rest of the history of England before the 11th century, because the next big stopping point is 1066 when the French, they're not yet French, the Normans invade. But in between times we have more invasions, Britain is an island of invasions, and these are the invasions which have been the most remembered, because these are the invasions which will give the name to the culture. Yet the Angles, England, the Saxons, we talk today in French, people talk about les pays anglo-saxons. Yeah. In England, people never say this because for us, America is completely different. It's like, Ethiopia, America. But in France, we don't want les pays anglo-saxons. Yeah. Okay, so the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes. From the late 5th century, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes, who came from Germany, which was not yet Germany, came in from the east coast. That's where they came. This is why we see that the Roman towns have more fortifications on the east, because that's where the danger is coming from. However, yes. Louder. How do you spell Jute? J-U-T-E. J-U-T-E, Jutes. Yeah, we always forget the Jutes, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes. We always forget the Jutes, the Angles. Yeah, it was they were the forgotten people. They had a completely different tactic from the Romans. Remember the Roman tactic? Occupy a country, integrate the elites with complete equality for the elites with Rome, and tax everybody else until they scream. Yeah, this is the Roman method. The Anglo-Saxon method was completely different. It was kill all the men, make the women into slaves. That was more the sort of thing. Yeah, the vast majority of the population did not survive. They did something very intelligent. They fought for a little bit, and then they ran away. Good idea, running away. Where did they run to? Scotland, Wales, Ireland, the Isle of Man, Cornwall, the extremities of the kingdoms, and this is where today the Celtic languages are spoken. The Celts were essentially massacred and expelled from England. The Anglo-Saxons did not seem interested in mingling and integrating. How do we know? Well, first of all, look at the names of the towns in Britain. The names of towns are very, very old. And how many Celtic names of towns are there in Britain? Almost zero. Almost none. Okay. Many, many towns in Britain have the end with ton, Islington, the end with ham, Birmingham, and hundreds of more, or an end with ing, Ealing, and many more. These are all Anglo-Saxon names. So they came and they really imposed the Anglo-Saxon culture, and they probably kept some Celts as slaves. But, it was not an integrating, the method was not to integrate. In fact, if you know the word Wales, we'll repeat again, in Saxon, Wales means foreigner. So this is what we know. We can see some remains of Celtic influence in Britain in the names of woods and rivers and streams. The towns, almost all have Anglo-Saxon names, or Viking names later. But the streams and rivers, the natural parts, often keep their Celtic name. Difficult to interpret. We're still in a period where it's very difficult to write history because we don't know very much. Yeah. Later on in the 20th century, we have the opposite problem. We know too much, and nobody agrees. So, by the beginning of the 7th century, the Angles and the Saxons had established their own kingdoms, and England was divided into seven kingdoms. There were seven kings and seven kingdoms. Kent, Sussex, Essex, you don't need all the names, East Anglia, Wessex, Mercia, and Northumbria. And interestingly enough, today, these are still names of counties. Yeah, so they have a historical basis. Now, the Angles and the Saxons who arrived were, of course, not Christians. Yeah? They worshipped the pagan gods. They worshipped Thor. That's where the word Thursday comes from. They worshipped the goddess Woden, Wednesday. Yeah, this is where they came from. They worshipped their old gods. But and the Celts, who moved away to Scotland and Ireland and Wales, were Christians, mostly. At least the elite were Christians. And so what you had was, a Christianization of Britain later. That is to say that from 700, the missionaries came from Rome to convert the Anglo-Saxons. And their priority was to convert the kings. Because if you convert the kings, the rest of them follow. Yes?
Sorry to go on, it's very loud. Are you going to put some course on the worship?
I'll probably put the recording on there. This is a recording, yeah. So I'll probably put the recording on there. So if it's going too fast for you, you'll be okay. Okay. Look on the blog where you have the address. Okay, so the missionaries came from Rome to convert to Christianity the Angles and the Saxons. The most important of these was Augustine. Saint Augustine, if you please. Yeah, he was made a saint much later. And Augustine arrived. He was an important intellectual in the church. How would you say that? He finalized a certain number of important Christian concepts. For example, original sin, le péché originel, this is Augustine who had this idea, and there was one more. Oh yeah, la guerre juste, the just war, this is Augustine's idea. Thank you, Augustine. Yeah, okay. In Ireland, it was Patrick, or Saint Patrick, who went to do the work of Christianizing Ireland. He had been a slave in Ireland for a long time, and when he went home, he saw visions asking him to go to, this is what he says, asking him to go to convert Ireland to Christianity. Okay, so that's the situation of the Angles and the Saxons, and we will see a little later they will have problems from another set of invaders, the Vikings, yeah, from the end of the 8th century, the Vikings will arrive. They will not take over the whole country, but they will take over a lot of it. So yeah, you have the Angles and Saxons, move the Celts out of the way, and later, 200 years later, little by little, the Vikings. Although the Vikings are rather special, because at the beginning they just come to steal, yeah, to pillage. Yeah, they raid, and then every year they stay a little longer. Yeah, and then they will settle there. Okay. In fact, for the 9th century, in the 9th century, most of England will be lost to the Vikings. Well, lost, will be occupied by the Vikings. And many people believe that it is because of Alfred the Great, le grand roi Alfred, that England did not become completely Viking and completely Danish. What did he do, Alfred the Great? Well, he won some victories against the Vikings. He also reformed Saxon law, stabilized the legal system, and he also, which is one of the reasons we historians, we like him, is that he organized the writing of a history of the islands, Okay, he organized the writing of a history of the islands. This is very useful. Of course, history at this time, you were allowed to make half of it up. It was okay to invent stories. That's not a problem, yeah? Okay, so it's not very, very reliable. And this is it. This is... this is the first page of one of the copies of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. This is the Peterborough Chronicle, and this is the first page. And it's simply a history, year by year, this is what happens. And some of the copies do 600 or 800 years of history, yeah? Approximate history, let's say, yeah? But this is very important, and it's also a sign that it was important to the elites, to the Saxon elite. History was important to them. They had an idea that they were here to stay. Okay, so that's the story. Let's have a look at different... let's go back to the invasions. That's the whole story. Let's go back to the invasions. The first real invasions were in the fifth century, and people they came from the north of Germany, and the Jutish Peninsula. I don't know where that is. Somewhere in the north of Germany. And again, at the beginning, they were just coming to raid. They were just coming to find gold and other goodies. But little by little, they settled in an England where, in fact, the towns were already declining. In fact, the towns were declining before the Romans left. The towns were already declining before the Romans left. And England was full of forests and marshes, des marais, des forêts, very difficult to cross. And very often the wonderful Roman roads were falling into disrepair, were not in such a good condition. The industry was not well developed. One of the reasons we know this is that when the Christians wanted to build a church, they had to ask for experts from France or Italy to come and help them build their churches. Yes, it's big, impressive churches, but there were not. It was not a great local culture of building. Okay. Now, one of the most famous characters from this era is King Arthur. You all know the story of King Arthur, probably from the Walt Disney version. Me too. The magic sword, somebody must pull a sword out of a stone, and if they pull the sword out of the stone, they will be king of all Britain, Excalibur and so on. Now, this is, of course, it's not history, but many people think that the story of King Arthur is a representative of the last resistance of the Celts against the Anglo-Saxon invaders. So it's a legend, but it is considered to have some basis. There is King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Yes, this is much later. This painting is much later, of course. And of course, the Round Table, so that they didn't have a boss. You can see some of the problems the tribes would have to resist the invasion because they were not united. They were not united, and so King Arthur, in the story, manages to unite them. But it's very delicate, and he needs a round table to do it. This story, although it's not a true story, has a number of elements which are probably historical. For example, we know that the Celts believed in different forms of magic. For example, magic writing, runes, magic writing, and the magic sword. And so on. And as I was saying, in Scotland, Ireland, Wales, and Cornwall, there are today Celtic or Gaelic languages spoken, and these come from those times. They are, of course, extremely different from English. Extremely different from English. They don't have verbs and things. Welsh is wonderful. You know how in Latin you change the end of the word if it's the subject of the sentence or the object of the sentence. In Welsh, you change the beginning of the word. Okay, it's murder writing dictionaries in Welsh. So the Saxons are arriving in Britain, founding the Kingdom of Kent in 449. The Kingdom of Kent, 547, the kingdom of Northumberland. And of course, they arrived with their gods and goddesses. They arrived with the worship of their gods and goddesses. Interesting point, yes, first of all, several gods and goddesses. And secondly, they are not all men. You have goddesses as well, which is generally considered to be a sign of more powerful women in the society, if you have goddesses as well. We have a couple of examples. The goddess Nerthus was very important. N-E-R-T-H-U-S, the goddess Nerthus. And another goddess called Eostre, which could be the origin of the word Easter. Easter of Pack. Eostre, E-O-S-T-R-E, could be the origin of that. And I have here a modern sculpture. This is a 20th century sculpture of Nerthus. So somebody in Norway still thinks that this goddess is an important goddess. There she is, hanging around. You can see that she is interested in babies. Now, the replacement of the Anglo-Saxon gods by Christianity was rather slow. Even in the 8th century, the Christian church had to work very hard on Thursdays. Because on Thursdays, everybody liked to worship the Anglo-Saxon god. That was difficult for them. Okay, however, the power of the Christians became bigger and bigger. And it was possible after 600... Do you mind not chewing them? Thank you. It was possible after 600 to convert pagan temples into Christian churches. So they started converting pagan temples and making them into Christian churches. And we know that before Christianity, they had not just magic writing, but also priest tabous, des tabous de prêtre. Now, of course, the Christians also have priest tabous. Priests cannot marry, cannot have sex. This is a priest taboo. Yeah, that priests are special and therefore must not do certain things. And they also had, the Saxons also had magical amulets, magical bracelets, and so on. Now, people converted to Christianity, but they continued believing some of the same things. And so, holy water, l'eau bénite, on dit en français. Yeah, it's something which really is not, there's nothing Christian about that. Yeah. It's not in the Bible at all. It's not. Jesus doesn't use holy water. It's an adaptation of a pagan tradition to encourage people, become a Christian. It won't change much. Yeah, it won't change things much. And of course, the church generally organized the big festivals at Christmas, when there was already a midwinter festival, and at Easter, when there was already a spring festival. Yeah, there was adaptation going on. Okay, so what did the Anglo-Saxons believe in otherwise? Well, they were in the habit of burying dead people with their property. Yeah, that if you had property, if you had money or gold, you were buried with the gold. Yeah, like the Egyptians, yeah. So this is the idea of an afterlife, a very traditional idea, not a modern idea today if you have a lot of money. I don't, but if I had a lot of money, I would be supposed to give it to my daughters and my sons. That's the modern tradition. Yeah? And in this tradition, you are buried with it. It's very important in the Anglo-Saxon society. The person who is very important is your lord. Loyalty to your lord is extremely important. And it is personal loyalty. It is not tribal loyalty. So you are not loyal to your tribe. You are loyal to one person, your lord. For example, if he is obliged to leave the country, sent into exile, you will want to go with him. If your lord is killed, you are obliged to revenge. You must revenge him. Yeah? This is the bonds of allegiance. You promise to be loyal to your lord by taking an oath of allegiance, a magical oath, and serment. And this is extremely serious for you. Really, if your lord dies, you probably want to die as well. Yeah, this is serious stuff. Yeah, it's worse than love. It's even worse than love. Okay. And in return, what do you receive? Well, you might well receive land from your lords as a gift. that's the situation, and you have these values of loyalty and vengeance, and you have the Christian values arriving. And there's a bit of conflict, but generally the church is very adaptable. And one of the reasons the church is so old is it's because it's extremely adaptable. So, for example, if your Lord is killed and in revenge you kill the murderer, the priest will say, okay, well, that's not good, but, say two prayers and it's okay. Yeah. The church would minimize, would generally accept reluctantly the ideas of vengeance, blood vengeance, and so on, which are directly anti-Christian. If you read Jesus, he says the opposite. And there is also still the blood feud. The blood feud is a conflict between families. Yeah, you killed my sister, so I must kill all your children, etc. You know, it's gore. It's pretty gore. So the Anglo-Saxon society divided into seven kingdoms. I'm not going to give you any details. There were often wars between this one and this one and this one and this one and so on. However, we were very, very lucky in 1939 because we didn't know a lot about the Anglo-Saxons. And suddenly at Sutton Hoo, that's S-U-T-T-O-N, new word H-O-O, they discovered a tomb of a rich Anglo-Saxon, and the tomb had never been disturbed, and so this was very, very good. This was very, very good news. And here I have some pictures from Sutton Hoo. I hope. Yeah, these are pictures in the British Museum in London. I think that it's a ship burial. That is, that you were buried in a ship. It's very interesting in itself, the value of the ship. You know, as a going on a voyage to the other world after your death. You can see there a sword, a shield and a helmet. There you have a helmet. This is probably, I'm not quite sure, 8th century, in Huitième siècle. There you have a helmet. You see, fairly sophisticated. This is just to decorate your belts. So they could do decoration. They were obviously, the kings were obviously pretty rich. Yeah, and I think we'll have some more. That's also, this is 8th century, and this is obviously very hard work to put together. Quite a sophisticated society that put that sort of stuff together. This is actually the reconstruction of the burial, and that's the situation he is in, and that's for later. Okay, so the rich kings. The king moved around the kingdom. The king did not stay in the same place. It was not possible to govern the whole country, or the whole of Wessex even, or the whole of Kent, by staying in the same place. No, you had to keep moving to make sure that, you know, people were loyal, give somebody a gift and punish somebody else, and just generally keep the things moving. The Christian priests, little by little, became more and more important. They were the only people who could probably read or write. They became the administrators. There is some sophistication in these societies. They are not only primitive tribes. For example, King Alfred, who was after 849 the King of Wessex, he organized his daughters to marry the daughters of kings in France, in different parts of France. There's a lot of diplomacy, you know, my daughter marries your son if we do this and so on. Okay, where did they get that? There is King Alfred. There's a statue of King Alfred looking like he's ready to save the country. Let's have a look at finance. Where did the money come from? Because you say in the modern detective story, we always say, cherchez la femme. But if you're trying to understand past societies, chercher l'argent is just as useful. Where did the money come from? Well, most of it is taxes, of course. It's taxes. And it's taxes on agriculture. The towns are not centres of production, not important centres of production. However, the people, the ordinary people, did not really have money, so they would pay taxes by cows or corn or so on, taxes in kind. There were also tolls. You had to pay to use the roads. And of course you had to pay if you did something you were not supposed to do. And you also had the labour dues, well, as you say in French, the corvée, that is to say, obligatory work for the king. And of course, military service. The duties were very complicated. For example, one village was obliged to provide all the dogs of the king, and another village was obliged to repair all the bridges. They were very, very complicated traditional links between people. This is before the victory of money. Now, money will simplify things in many ways. But before this, there's long traditions. Oh, yes, this village has always repaired bridges for 500 years, and this village has always provided dogs for the king. Yeah, so the ideas of tradition. Religion was extremely important. When they converted to Christianity, this was a great unifying force in Britain, but also across Europe. For example, King Alfred, half of his income was spent on religion. 50% de son revenu était dépensé pour la religion. So, c'est pas un petit détail. It's not like today, on Sunday morning I go to church and I forget it on Monday morning. I'm not talking about you, but other people. It's very much, very, extremely central. This is still a society where you die for unknown reasons frequently. Well, not each person does not die frequently, but you see a lot of people dying, and it's very frightening time. So we have the invasions of the Vikings, and sometimes the Anglo-Saxons fight. And sometimes they pay the Danes. Please go away. Here is some money. Yeah. Now the king is obviously very rich. On the other hand, if you are king, if there is a war, you must be at the front of the army. Yeah. If you're going to be a king, it's better to be a king today and not in Anglo-Saxon times, because today you stay at home. The whole of the society is very much extremely hierarchical. Of course, all societies that we know are hierarchical, but this is even more so. For example, under Anglo-Saxon law, they had a system called Wergilt. This is Wergild. And this is quite simply the price of your life. So if you are an aristocrat and I kill you, then I must pay, I don't know, £50. But if you are a peasant and I kill you, I only have to pay £1. Yeah, there's actually a fixed price for compensating if you kill people for no reason. Now, in some ways, we find this is not very modern. We find this a little shocking. But it was probably better than the previous system, which is the blood feud. Yeah, if I kill him, his family must kill three of my family, and if they do, then my family must kill six of his family, and it can continue for 100 years. So the Wergild was probably an advance. So after the kings, you have the kings, you have the noble women, the aristocrats, you have the free men, and you have the slaves. Yes, 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 of course. Now, the noble men and noble women, the aristocrats, could have big estates. They would sometimes have 20 or 30 big farms each. However, almost all of the building was in wood. There are not a lot of stone buildings, and this is the reason why we don't have them anymore. They have disappeared. The archaeologists are very sad, because wood buildings, you can't see them anymore. And land is becoming more and more important, and over these centuries, what you really see is the emergence of an aristocratic elite based on the fact that they own land. And this is a little new, because previously you were the leader because you were the best warrior, the best fighter. And this is the new thing: you are the leader because you have the most land. Yeah, so this is it's a move towards modernity. So let's have a look at the churls. C-H-U-R-L-S. The word churl means free man. And it is the origin of one adjective which still exists today, churlish, ce qui veut dire vulgaire ou quelque chose plus ou moins comme ça, churlish. It's not a very common word. Where did they live, these free people? Well, they lived in houses a little bit like this. Here is an Anglo-Saxon house. It is not a real one. It is a construction. It is in fact, it's a drawing. It's not even a construction. It's a drawing. Now, you can see the advantages and disadvantages of this house. The main disadvantage is there is... Well, yeah, what's the disadvantage? The disadvantage. It can burn. It can burn. Yes, that's a disadvantage, yes. And in particular, there is no chimney. Yeah, put a chimney. Yeah? Huh? Just smoke. Yeah, it's not so good. Yeah, you can make a hole in the roof if you want, but this is normal because it's quite difficult to build chimneys in wood. Yeah, it does not look a lot of fun at all to live in. These are the ordinary people of the time. There's another example. They look very happy. In fact, yes, these are happy Anglo-Saxons. Another example. It's a reconstruction of the time. There's something I forgot to say about the aristocracy, and it was that men and women were very powerful in the aristocracy. Later on, it will be men, and women will be absolutely inferior. But in this period, the women of the elite have a lot of freedom. They have a lot of freedom, more than they have later. For example, noble women in the Anglo-Saxon period can own land in their own name. And much later, in the 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th century, for 800 years, it will be illegal for women to own land in their own name. The land must belong to their husband. So in fact, it's not the situation of women is not purely advanced. There was a real move backwards in the 11th century. Here you have the Anglo-Saxon free men, often living in fairly poor houses, and a very complex system of duties. On the one hand, they must do this work for the king. On the other hand, the shepherd is allowed to keep his sheep with the king's sheep, and so on and so forth. The system of agriculture is the open field system. That is to say that around the village, if you have 20 freemen, each person will have a few strips of land, one over here, one over here, one over here, and this was the open field system. It's not very efficient, but people have a lot more time than money. Honey was a very important product at the time, because there's no sugar, so honey was very important. Famine was absolutely not unusual. Every few years there was a famine, a local famine or a national famine. It was not easy for people to get enough food to live, but they also had, of course, time to enjoy themselves. Minstrels, buffoons, acrobats. Yeah, there's the festivals and so on, and wonderful sports like bull baiting. C'est tourmenter le taureau. You get a bull and you get a burning stick and you go and stick it in him. Is that great? Yeah? Okay. Also, cockfighting. Yeah, le combat de coq. I think bull baiting is better. Yeah, okay. Now, of course, bull baiting we consider today to be pretty cruel. On the other hand, compared with gladiators, yeah, it's a kind of a kind of step forward. Church, of course, is very important. Alcohol, extremely important. Yeah, alcohol is extremely important. The church had great difficulties calming people down. It was very normal on Sundays to have people completely drunk in the church and fighting, and it's that kind of time. Yeah. And finally, then, so I've talked about the kings and the noblemen and women and the freemen, and at the bottom you have the slaves. You have the slaves. Where do you find the slaves? Most of the slaves are prisoners of war. If Kent has a war with Essex, the winner has slaves from the other side. Yeah, so these are just local slaves. Yeah, they came from the town up the road. The slaves being very intelligent. When the Vikings arrived, when the Vikings invaded, quite often the slaves ran away. I'm a slave here. Hello, Mr. Viking. Can I join you? Join you? Yeah. So they went and joined the Vikings. Good idea, and then they weren't slaves anymore. They joined the Viking army. Sometimes slaves were allowed to buy their freedom. So some of the slaves were descendants of the Celtic population. Others were prisoners of war. And some of them were made slaves as punishment for a crime. Yeah, if you did a bad crime, you are going to be made into a slave. Finally, if people were very hungry, you could always sell your children as slaves. Yeah. Don't tell your mothers and fathers this, okay? Keep it secret. Okay. Now, the Christian church already at this time, this will change later, but at this time the Christian church was not happy about slavery and tried to encourage people to free their slaves. This will change later. The Christian church will like slavery much later. Not a lot of trade at the time. Probably the biggest trade is slaves, but there is also trade in cheese, fish, jewels, and wine. And by the end of this period, some of the towns are becoming quite big. Okay, so the end of the period is 1066. Yeah, this is the period from when the Romans left in 410. When the Normans arrived in 1066, we're looking at this period between these two. So by the end of the period, some of the towns were quite big. Norwich had nearly 7,000 people and 20 churches. Lincoln had about 7,000 people and 12 churches. Yes. This is the kind. This is a big town at the time. The law came from the laws in Germany, the Anglo-Saxon law. They arrived from Germany, but it was adapted to the Christian religion. Little by little, it was adapted to the Christian religion. And this is still the case today. Much of the law was never written down. It was oral law. And this has remained a tradition in Britain. That, of course, as you know, Britain does not have a written constitution, yeah? And there are many things which are not written down. When the English look at France and they see the Code Civil, like this, they go, oh my God, you know, why do you need so many laws, yeah? There's a cultural difference here. Okay, so we've got these Vikings arriving, and at the end of the 9th century, donc juste avant 900, a part of the country was abandoned to the Danes, the Vikings, was left to the Vikings. And perhaps you know that the town York, the origin of the name is Jorvik, which was a Viking name. It was renamed by the Vikings. And to go back to the law, Anglo-Saxon law included the possibility of outlawing somebody. You call this in French, mettre quelqu'un hors la loi. Donc les expulsés de la civilisation, c'est un hors la loi. This was possible. They were expelled from the community. And also they still had magical trials. Let me give you an example of a magical trial. Yes, if this young lady is accused of something, I have the solution. How do we know if she's innocent or if she's guilty? Well, here is some very, very hot water, and we put her arm in the hot water for 10 minutes, and we take it out again. And 3 days later, if her arm has healed and is okay again, she's innocent. And if it hasn't healed, she's guilty. Do you agree to this? No? No? Yeah, okay, so this is magical trials. Okay, this is magical trials. Yes. This is Anglo-Saxon law. But it has not completely disappeared. Today in England, not in France, but today in England, if you are in a trial, in a tribunal, you swear on the Bible. I swear on the Bible. I swear by Almighty God. And so this is still a form of magic, yes, that if I tell a lie with my hand on the Bible, it's a terrible thing for me. Yeah? So still these magical ideas are around. Final thing about the law, before I go on to something else. Divorce was quite possible. This is part of the what I was saying, the position of women, in particular women of the elite, was better in the 8th century than 400 years later. And divorce was quite possible if a woman in Kent, wanted a divorce, she was entitled to half of the goods of the family, which is a situation which will not exist again until the end of the 19th century. Yeah, so it's a very, very modern situation. Let's have a look at forced marriage was banned. Yeah, le mariage forcé était interdit. Ce qui est au 8e siècle, c'est incroyable. Let's have a little look in a little more detail at the church. I mentioned St. Augustine, here he is. St. Augustine, just to give you a picture, it's not a photograph. So St. Augustine arrives in Britain to convert the Anglo-Saxon kings. There is some resistance, and in particular, they have a little problem with the British church. Okay, so the British church is the church in Scotland and Wales, you know, the Celts who have been moved out. They are Christians, and the Anglo-Saxon kings are newly Christian. They've just become Christians. They've just decided to become Christians. And St. Augustine comes along and organizes a conference between all of them together, but they don't find agreements. And it was very, very close, because this is a period where the Pope in Rome is not very powerful. And it is St. Augustine who will organize and rationalize the church in Britain, and he will ensure that all of the church in Britain, England and Scotland and Wales, will be in the structure of Rome, will be a Roman church. But c'était tout juste, il a failli perdre là. And what did they do then? They sent out pilgrimages to Rome, des pèlerinages jusqu'à Rome, and they sent out missionaries to pagan areas. Now, the Christian church at this time was an amazing international organization. Two of the important missionaries who came to England, one of them was from Asia Minor, and one of them was from Africa. The Christian religion at this time, this is before the invention of racism, and so the Christian church would say, oh, send an African over there, send an Asian over there, and they sent an Englishman as a missionary, very important missionary to Germany. The patron saint of Germany, whose name I have forgotten, was English. He's the man who came to convert Germany. Yeah, so these are important things. Of course, the church is also the only place with education. The only people who have education is the church, and here are some of the things they do with it. That's Augustine again. Oh, this is an Anglo-Saxon church. There are a few Anglo-Saxon churches which still exist. Yes, this is... This is an extremely old church from the 10th century, I think, 9th or 10th century, and that's what they looked at. C'est bien construit, ça durait donc 1000 ans. Ça durait 1000 ans, ça va. Okay. This is what I was showing you. This is the part of the Lindisfarne Gospels. You can see it's written at the top. These are very famous and beautiful Gospels from the 8th century, sorry, the 7th century. And one of the things we know about these books is that they were copied and illustrated by women as well as men, which again is something which later on will be impossible. And at the same time, there are new books being written both in Latin and in English. I think I have more of the Lindisfarne Gospels here. This is from the Lindisfarne Gospels as well, 7th century art. Again, 7th century art. Later. There is also some literature from the time. We have some surviving literature from the time when they were very violent people. And the most famous piece is Beowulf. And I found this on the internet, which is Beowulf the Game. Yeah. This is not 7th century. Okay, this is not 7th century. We think it is 8th or 9th century Beowulf. And it is a story written in England, but the story happens in Denmark. So you can see they're still thinking of, you know, our heroic past in Denmark. And he is attacked by a dragon, and he attacks the dragon but does not succeed. And finally, he kills the dragon but is mortally wounded and dies. I don't know how to win the game, I'm afraid. I'm sorry about that. Also Anglo-Saxon sculpture. This is what we call this. This is a 9th century piece of jewellery. We call it the Alfred's Jewel. The Alfred Jewel from Alfred the Great. We don't know if it is necessarily from Alfred the Great. But it is, and of course, these are just the ones which survive. We imagine there must be much more which did not survive. You can also, in some churches in Britain, you can see Anglo-Saxon carving. That's an Anglo-Saxon carving from... That's a virgin and child. Yes, c'est la Vierge Marie et Jésus. And also you can see something else. Perhaps you can see it at the top right. This is the hand of God. This is the hand of God reaching down to help you. Yeah. God has only 2 fingers. Maybe that's why he's such a bitter sort of person. Yeah. Okay. That's right. The Anglo-Saxon cross. Here another one. This is another Anglo-Saxon bas-relief. I don't know if you know. How many people had a Christian education apart from me? Anybody? Oh, a few people. Good. Okay, who's this? Qui le grand monsieur à droite? No, Jesus. Okay? And who is the man who is coming out of his tomb? C'est qui sort de sa tombe? Thank you. Yes?
Lazarus.
Thank you. Lazarus. Yeah, Lazarus. Saint-Lazare. Yeah. Okay, faut réviser, hein? Okay, right, yeah. Sinon vous serez puni. Vous serez puni. Okay.
Okay.
And this is a famous Anglo-Saxon cross. This is an Anglo-Saxon cross from the 10th century. It's very tall. Why not? I don't know why they did them so tall. Okay, so that's more or less the end of the story of the invasions, that you get the Anglo-Saxons who expel the Celts around the north, which still causes problems today, and then when the Vikings arrive, occupy parts of the country for a long time, but are stopped from occupying the rest by Alfred the Great, and after that, there is a sort of mixing together of the Vikings, Danes, and the Anglo-Saxons, which will be the situation when the Normans arrive in 1066. And that's the story for next week. Thank you for listening.